Hey, everybody. This is April Bear. I'm the host of Stateside. We wanted to take a second to let you know that Michigan Radio is asking for your help today. You probably noticed we didn't hold our spring fundraiser this year because of COVID-19. The money that folks like you contribute makes up most of the cash that we need to operate every day. If you're in a position to contribute, even a little, please go over to michiganradio.org right now so we can keep on delivering for you. We don't have to tell you. These are really intense times. We're so grateful to be doing this work for you. Let's get on to today's episode. And thanks. From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Bear. Today, a Michigan doctor talks about his own experiences on a ventilator in treatment for COVID-19.
I actually asked to be intubated. I knew that it would help me with my breathing. I knew that it would allow me to rest, or my body to rest and fight better, but I had no idea that it would get this bad.
Also, the pandemic leaves small business owners taking a hard look at what's ahead.
My business and many other businesses and organizations out there have to think about their future. And do we scale back on some things? Do we merge with another business? Do we come together and share space with someone else?
And we check in with writer and funeral director Thomas Lynch about this unique period of mourning.
I've always thought of funerals as essentially a collaboration between the living and the dead.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Bear. Today, we want to introduce you to a doctor with a very personal story to tell about COVID-19. In mid-March, Eugene Vovchuk was going about his work as an anesthesiologist at Detroit Medical Center's Harper University Hospital. Eugene's 38 years old, and he'd heard about the virus, of course, but he hadn't seen any cases. Not yet. And he was not prepared for his own ordeal, including nearly a month in the hospital and weeks on a ventilator. Dr. Vovchuk, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, first of all, how you're doing right now? You're a couple weeks out from having been discharged, but obviously this isn't something you get better from overnight.
So I'm getting stronger and better every day, but I'm still very weak. I get winded very easily, so low endurance. I lost a lot of muscle mass laying in the hospital for over 2.5 weeks. And picking up my children, who are 1 and 3 and weigh less than 30 pounds, is an extreme task. I get physical therapy 3 times a week, and the exercises we're doing are with 5-pound weights. And to me, they feel like 30, 40-pound weights, 50-pound weights.
What was it like being a patient yourself?
It was humbling. It was at times difficult. Just in terms of being inpatient, in my profession, I'm used to having things done right away, and that's not really how it works, being a patient. So it was definitely humbling and definitely a different experience than being on the other side, taking care of patients.
Will you tell us a little bit about your symptoms? I understand at first you thought it was influenza. Was it just sort of a standard package of fever and aches and coughing?
So I didn't think it was influenza. I thought it was maybe food poisoning. I had a lot of GI problems. Nausea, diarrhea, and high fevers were my symptoms for the first 9 to 10 days. That's why I thought maybe it wasn't COVID-19. It was something else. I did get tested right away. So on Friday, March 13th, I had a fever of 103.4. And earlier that evening, I saw in the news that Beaumont Hospital was doing drive-through testing, and they were kind of the only ones in the area that were doing any sort of testing. So I drove there, got tested, and called in to work saying that I'm not going to be coming in next week.
Right.
And even though the hospital said it would take 24 to 48 hours for the test results to come back, it took 9 days for the test results to come back, and I was negative. But, you know, I was feeling awful and had high fevers that weren't relieved by Tylenol. And I was taking Tylenol around the clock every 6 hours, and taking my temperature around the clock. And the fevers just wouldn't go down. 2 days before I received my negative test result, I went back to Beaumont, and instead of doing the drive-through, I went into the ER because they had, at that time, they had a rapid test that would come back in, I believe, like 4 to 6 hours. So hoping I would be able to get that test. Unfortunately, that test was only set aside for really sick patients, kind of on ventilators. And so I was not able to get that test. I had other blood work done. I had a chest x-ray done. Everything was normal. So they sent me home. So it was difficult to try to get a second test done.
Do you know what finally turned the tide on that for you?
Well, I believe I got tested at Harper Hospital again when I got admitted. And then when I got transferred to University of Michigan, I definitely got tested there. And that's where I know of that I had a positive test or a positive result for the COVID-19. And then prior to leaving the hospital, I had a few more tests to make sure that I was virus-free.
Given that you had such a high fever, I was wondering how much of your hospitalization you actually remember.
Not a lot. And it's a lot of it isn't due to my high fever. A lot of it is that on my admission to Harper Hospital, they took another chest x-ray and told me you're developing pneumonia. And from then on, it progressed very quickly with just a shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, me requiring higher and higher levels of oxygen, and eventually being intubated, placed on a ventilator. And at that point, even the reason I got transferred to University of Michigan is there was concern that I might need ECMO, which is a heart and lung bypass system that is commonly used as a temporary measure while you treat the underlying disease. The program is not completely set up at Harper Hospital. That's why I was transferred to University of Michigan. And luckily I did not need ECMO and I was able to just stay on the ventilator. But being on the ventilator, I was heavily sedated. At times I was paralyzed to help the ventilator do its job and provide, you know, oxygenation to my vital organs.
We know that some hospitals have tried different kinds of prescription treatments for the symptoms or the conditions associated with COVID-19, hydrochloroquine, ketamine. Do you know much about the drugs that you were given in the hospital?
So the hydrochloroquine and azithromycin, I heard about it while I was still at home. And I have a friend who's a pharmacist and was able to find a pharmacy about 45 minutes away from my house that had the hydrochloroquine. And so I had another colleague of mine call in a prescription for me. So I started that medication while I was home. It was continued while I was in the hospital, I think for a total of 10 days. I don't know if that helped or not.
Did you think that things were going to get as bad as they did?
No, I really didn't. I actually asked to be intubated. I knew that it would help me with my breathing. I knew that it would allow me to rest or my body to rest and fight better. But I had no idea that it would get this bad.
Eugene, you're married and you have 2 kids who are both under the age of 3. As all this was happening, how was your family taking all of this?
Oh, they were devastated. My wife learned a lot of medicine very quickly. You know, she had to call physicians daily, or actually at certain points she was getting hourly updates on how I was doing from both nurses and physicians. So she was very strong, and it was extremely stressful for her because she had to take care of 2 small children on top of being quarantined, on top of me being gravely ill.
What was it like to see your wife and kids again after you started coming out of it?
It was, you know, incredible. Once I was with it mentally, you know, I started realizing what had happened and how lucky I was to survive. And I felt, and I still do feel that, you know, I'm either like reborn or I have a second chance at life. It was just very awe-inspiring kind of feeling to see them again and to realize what I've been through.
Eugene, you're in such an unusual position given that you've got this front row seat on medicine through your job. And at the same time, you've experienced something that a growing number of Americans are dealing with, and that's having had COVID-19. Do you have any different view of the reaction to the pandemic in terms of the seriousness of it and the timelines that are put on us for physical distancing because of the experience that you had in the hospital?
Oh, absolutely. I know a lot of people are protesting the extension of staying at home and being quarantined. Me, on the other hand, I'm all for it. You know, this is a very serious disease. You know, a lot of people, because they've been either asymptomatic carriers or they had a mild form of the disease, think that everyone had the same experience. But, you know, me being steps away from dying because of this disease, I'm definitely going to be a lot more conservative, and I feel everyone should be more conservative in terms of social distancing and being quarantined and, you know, washing their hands and doing all those things, wearing masks.
What does getting back to normal look like for you? I wonder if, given the extensive recovery period that a lot of COVID patients have to go through, what's your timeline? Are you thinking you'll be back to work by the end of the year?
Probably by December, for sure. So towards the end of my hospital stay, I had daily physical therapy and I got to talk to a lot of physical therapists. And they said that for every week that I'm in the hospital or kind of bedbound, it takes 4 to 6 weeks to recover strength. So given the fact that I was hospitalized almost 3 weeks, I'd say 3 to 4 months is what I would need with intensive physical therapy to kind of get back to where I was prior to being hospitalized.
Dr. Eugene Vovchuk, an anesthesiologist at DMC Harper in Detroit and a survivor of the new coronavirus. You can find our full conversation with Eugene at our website. It's michiganradio.org. In a moment, funeral director Thomas Lynch talks about what grieving means when you can't come together.
Grief will have its way with us. If you love, you grieve. It's almost like the tax that we pay on love.
That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Physical distancing rules that we're all living with right now also apply to funerals. Even as many families have people to mourn, beloved people who lived long lives full of folks who are missing them, we're not really in a position to gather for long remembrances full of stories and tears and laughs, with plates of food to pass around and glasses to raise. So how do we grieve and honor the dead right now? Thomas Lynch is funeral director and president at Lynch & Sons Funeral Home. It serves several communities in western Michigan, including Brighton, Lapeer, and Walled Lake. He's also a poet and essayist. Thomas Lynch, welcome.
Thanks, April. I'm glad to be here.
Will you tell us where you are right now?
I'm at the south end of Mullet Lake in northern Michigan, about a half hour south of the bridge, and my son, Michael, embargoed my being in the office because I have all of the preconditions that would make me high risk. So he sent me up here to live alone with a dog.
And The
dog's getting tired of it, but we're doing okay.
Yeah, I wonder if it's difficult to be away from work right now.
It is, and particularly because I know the pressure they're under in a lot of ways, not only the actual work that must be done, but I think for everybody involved in last things, the families that, you know, we're serving and the dead that we're trying to get to their proper dispositions. I think this physical distancing and the contagion, both informs and bewilders us. So I spend the day on the phone and on virtual meetings and trying to, you know, assist them in ways that I can. But the real work is the heavy lifting and the large muscles, the heart and the shoulders and the rest of it.
You've been at this for many years now. What do you see funerals doing for us at a time when we've lost someone?
I've always thought of funerals as essentially a collaboration between the living and the dead. And so I see the essential elements of a funeral. You know, we tend to concentrate on all the accessories, the boxes, the bagpipers, the mum plants and hoopla. But the real essentials of a funeral are four. You need a corpse, someone who agrees to quit breathing forever. And sadly, we're inundated with those from strange sources that we never have had before. You need mourners, someone to whom it matters. You need a story, and the story is about the one who has died, and it's not only their biography, but it's also what they believed in, what they hoped for, what they held close to their heart, their spiritual and religious impulses, the things that informed their values. And finally, and very importantly, we need the transport. We need to get the dead where they need to go, because by doing so, the living get where they need to be. So it is this collaborative conduct that every culture, you know, as long as, you know, for 50,000 years, if you watch a certain channel, will tell you that humans are distinguished by the fact that they do these things. They pause when one of their own kind dies. So those four things, April: corpse, mourners, story, and transport. And the trouble with the current pestilence is that it separates those things physically, and they are basically physical enactments. A corpse is not the idea of the thing. The body is the thing itself, and it is by getting the body where it needs to go. In the case of our dead, they need to get burned or buried or entombed or into some abyss that we choose for them, whether it's the sea or the grave or the fire or the tomb. By getting them there, we get to do that. And by showing up to assist the family with that, we're saying, we'll take our part of that burden, that heavy lift. Mm. We'll help you carry that. And that's not happening now because we fear contact with one another, and properly so.
Well, what are the restrictions on the funeral services that Lynch and Sons can offer right now? Are there certain practices that you've had to put in place?
We've had to, of course, limit the number of people who can participate to 10. That's by, you know, the directive of our governor, and by the good orderly direction of the CDC and common sense dealing with the coronavirus. So that only takes the immediate family to where, you know, they can basically see and say goodbye briefly to their dead, and then they can carry them to their final disposition, whether it's the open grave or the open fire or whatever it happens to be. And that's hard duty to be done alone. But by the time you have pallbearers and, you know, an immediate family, my mother's sister, our Aunt Sally, died yesterday, the bed of heaven to her.
I'm so sorry.
And she was 92. And I know someplace in the sparkling future there will be a religious ceremony to mark her long faith life and the hope that she had of heaven. And but right now, I think she's probably being buried, and the people who bury her, like the people who probably consoled her in the, you know, the care facility that she was in these last months, they're doing the best they can to bring humanity to bear on that circumstance, but they are not the people that she would want or would want to be with her. So it's these are difficult times, and we hope to make up the difference in future, but we have to wait and see and take a day at a time and keep the grieving and the mourners in our prayers, because in a sense they're trying to do a virtual lift and a virtual transport.
Right.
And they don't have anyone to tell the story to.
Well, part of what you do is to provide that emotional support as people go through the rituals of their grief. Are there ways that you can help at a distance?
Every time we give, you know, every time a family seizes on the sort of deeply human duty of taking care of their dead, they are moving in the right direction when it comes to dealing with their grief. We deal with death, April, by dealing with our dead. We sometimes think that, you know, a memorial service or a celebration of life will do the job, and it may well do, but the essentials have to be there. And among the essentials is the dealing with our dead, and not the idea of them, not a photograph, not a recording. Those things will stand in when they have to. But in the best case scenario, the ways that we conjure our dead usually happen in community, in cahoots with the people we love the most and who loved our dead the most with us. So that communion is very important. And to the extent that the current plague disallows that, we are hurt by it.
You know, because our society tends to be averse to talking about these things, many of us don't have the language to talk about death and grief on a daily basis. But funeral directors certainly have those skills. Do you have any thoughts on how to cope with seeing so much grief all around us right now?
I don't know that funeral directors are any more expert than other humans. And I think that if we love, we grieve. And to the extent that we do love, we, you know, grief will have its way with us. So the things that help us most in grief are is the companionship of others who are willing to share our grief. The rule of thumb, Edgar Jackson, an old Methodist minister, may his memory be eternal, used to say that grief shared is grief diminished. It's as if you have this stone you have to push uphill. I think it was a myth by that name. But the more the merrier, April. The more people who get under the box that has to be lifted from this place to the next, the lighter the load is for everyone. So to the extent that FaceTime and all the social medias put us in closer contact, even though we're only getting glimpses and virtual glimpses of one another, those things all help. This morning I watched the funeral mass of a funeral director friend of mine who died last week, and the mass was in Gaylord. His name was Chuck Nelson. Since I was a boy, painting parking blocks for my father's funeral home, I remember Chuck Nelson because he served his apprenticeship with us. And here he is at the end of his life, his darling Patricia, I think they were married for ever and a day. She's there with her children, but they had 10 people at a mass that would have had thousands, because Chuck had been the funeral director in Gaylord for well over half a century. But we must take care of one another the best way we can. So, you know, I've attended virtual 12-step meetings, virtual poetry readings, virtual book club meetings. If you ring me, I'll be in any meeting, because otherwise I'm talking to Carl the dog, and he doesn't know the pandemic's on. So he just thinks this is normal. And it's not. It's not. We need one another. And if there is a silver lining, as they say, possibly we'll know that need more keenly when this is over.
Do you worry about people becoming numb to death and to grief in this moment when so many people all around the world are just wrapped in it?
What I worry about is the disconnect, April. I mean, grief is going to have its way with us. My father, may he rest in peace, used to say, you can pay the undertaker, pay the bartender, pay the shrink, but you're going to pay the price. Grief will have its way with us. If you love, you grieve. It's almost like the tax that we pay on love. And we can delay our taxes by a couple months, as we've done. But they are still certain as our mortality. The numbers are really convincing on this. 100% of us who are born die. And grief, which is the other side of that coin of love, will come calling for its pittance, whatever it might be.
You know, no one goes into your line of work, I think, unless they're prepared to meet people on their lowest days. Do you find in talking to the folks who are on site at the business right now that this work has changed for them in the past couple of weeks?
They are remarkable. I think the men and women in funeral service across the nation and around the world are, we call them the last responders, but they are every bit as exposed to the real costs of this contagion as anyone else is. But they go about their work because that's what they were called to do, and they see it, I am certain, not just as a living, but as a way of life, and not just as a job, but a calling, a true vocation. And those who do it well, not only do they see the dismal trade, the dark days, the hearts that are broken, but they also see the long history of love, the years of a long marriage, the way that she stubbed her toe and he said, ouch. And that they're going to have to learn another way to do it now. That's a spectacularly meaningful line of work to be in. I mean, I've always found it more meaningful than anything else. And I think my colleagues do as well, or they wouldn't do it.
Thomas Lynch is funeral director and president of Lynch and Sons Funeral Home. Mr. Lynch, thank you so much, both for your work and for your thoughts right now.
Thanks, April. God bless.
1.5 million Michigan students have been home now for almost 10 weeks, sheltering in place. Everything they knew is different now. They can't hang out with friends or go to school, not physically anyway. Most have no real schedules to speak of. Students from Community High School in Ann Arbor called our hotline to talk about it and shared how some are coping with it better than others.
It's 11:47 on Monday. Oh, God, I think it's the 13th. I don't even know anymore.
I can't remember what week it is. Honey, all the weeks are blending together.
I started really thinking this morning about how apocalyptic this all feels.
My brain can't comprehend the amount of trauma and chaos that is in the world right now.
I was kind of expecting things to die down a little bit, but I was wrong.
I feel like the past week or so I've been super unmotivated. I'm used to always having things to do, and now that I don't, it's like the days go by super fast, and all I've done is like watch TV and maybe gone on a walk or like eaten a lot of toast or something.
My family, most of us started showing like really mild symptoms.
My aunt has corona, which is scary, not very bad, but still, that's the first person I've known to have it.
My dad went back to the hospital today. We know he's taking every precaution, but the thought of him being so exposed is terrifying.
I have definitely been struggling a little bit more with just kind of the feeling lonely and just missing my friends.
I haven't hugged another person who isn't my mom, dad, or brother in 3 weeks. And it's just like hard to wrap my mind around that. This break is like mentally really, has been really good for me and refreshing. And I think it's just given me a lot of time to just think about the future.
Before all this, I was so busy and it was really hard for me to have quality time with my parents, especially having divorced parents and going back and forth. It was like my time is already so limited and now I have more time. And I think that this has really just taught me to appreciate what I have and be grateful for what I can look forward to when this is done.
Everything is just different, and I hate that people keep calling this the new normal, because I don't want this to be the new normal. I want this to be a temporary normal, and I want things to just go back to the way they were when everything was okay. All right, bye-bye.
We just heard from a senior at Community High in Ann Arbor. This piece was produced by Michigan Radio's Rachel Ishikawa. Support for Michigan Radio comes from the Michigan Health Endowment Fund and the Children's Foundation. Small businesses are finding ways to deal with the shutdown order, and in many cases, informal networks may be those in the best position to help. That story is coming up after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. All small businesses have been impacted in some way by stay-at-home orders. It's tough for folks who deal in perishable products, those who rely on word of mouth and casual walk-ins, and perhaps it's especially difficult for people of color who've had a unique set of challenges getting their business started. This particular intersection is where we find Jamel Eddy. He owns Malamaya Juice Bar and Eatery in downtown Grand Rapids. He founded it with his wife in 2013. Jamel, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me on.
Will you tell us a little bit about your place?
Yeah, we are what I would consider a community center. Community is essentially the center of our business. And so I guess it'd be a non-traditional community center. Malamaya Juice Bar started in 2013 and is named after my three boys, Malachi, Nehemiah, and Josiah. And we get Malamaya and we make juices, smoothies, we do salads and wraps and other health immunity booster shot beverages. And essentially we just want to provide the community with love, and it's just coming in the way of our healthy products.
So what was your reaction when you'd first heard that the stay-at-home order was coming down?
My first reaction was that if it's happening in that way, it's probably going to be best for the overall community, for the end result to get through this. But from a business perspective, I was thinking, oh my gosh, I made a significant investment in a place that has the opportunity and possibility of lots of foot traffic, and it doesn't seem that there's going to be any of that right now. And so it was like, okay, I can either stop the business and just go sit at home, or I can do all that I can to keep my employees employed and to keep my business alive and to keep the community healthy.
There was one thing I've been really curious about, and that is how delivery is going. When mm-hmm. this started, I think you were taking orders with some of the mass market services, and I believe yes. you're doing it yourself now. Could you talk to us about the challenges of getting the product in the hands of customers?
Sure, yeah, we did. We were working with two other organizations when it came to a delivery for our customers, getting the juices and our other products to them. And when we switched to a model, what we originally called Malamaya door-to-door or door delivery, it's like, how are we going to make that possible? And so I'm using my personal vehicle to go out and about to different homes. And so one of the issues as temperature begins to change is ensuring that the product is still cold upon arrival.
Right.
And so So I'm driving with big coolers in my car, and I'm pulling up at people's homes and their driveways and hopping out. And I think people are kind of skeptical to look out the window or to open the door because we're all supposed to be staying at home. And so what I ended up doing is just leaving it on the doorstep, and I would send a text message to say, hey, your juices have been delivered and they're at the door. The only way that this is possible, though, is that the company Well Design, who operated our website, they immediately acted on switching our brand new website that we just launched to switching it again for deliveries only.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Have you tried to apply for any of the federal loans or grants that are available right now?
I did. I applied for whatever I could. I spent hours and nights and everything just trying to apply for all of this stuff. You get some mental and emotional fatigue, I tell you. And so, the mental fatigue is there. The emotional fatigue is there when you get that email to say you did not get something. But yeah, we were able to apply for a lot of the things early on.
You know, every small business is hurting right now, but I've got to believe that there are additional barriers for Black-owned businesses that may have issues with access to capital and other factors.
Oh, yes, yes. A lot of people will say that the COVID-19, the coronavirus, has brought to surface all of the racial disparities, socioeconomic disparities in our country. But those of us who are in the communities that have those despairs, like the African-American community, the Latino community, other communities, we've been experiencing this for forever. And when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, the folk there said, hey, I don't think the government or anyone's coming to save us. We got to get together and save ourselves. And that's the climate that we're in right now, is we have to come together amongst ourselves, neighbor to neighbor, door to door, business to business. And so when it comes to access to funds as a small business, we're sitting out here helping each other. We're putting up Facebook pages and text message groups saying, hey, did you apply for this? Hey, did you apply for that? And some of what I'm finding is some individuals may not have the financial accounting measures in place to apply for some of the funds because they're asking for a profit and loss statement or a balance sheet. And so I'm doing the best that I can with the knowledge that I have to help people find those things, to tell people about these applications. And some of the reason why some of us don't have these in play is because we didn't know.
Right.
The field has never been even. And so some knowledge of how to run a business or that you need to have X, Y, and Z in place, we just didn't know. We weren't told.
Do you have any sense at this point of what recovery might look like for your business?
For my business, recovery is going to, I think it's going to be interesting to figure out what exactly that's going to be. But I do know that my business and many other businesses and organizations out there have to think about their future. And do we scale back on some things? Do we merge with another business? Do we come together and share space with someone else? And so with Malamaya Juice Bar and Eatery, we're thinking about that every single day. We're thinking about what are the essential items that we need to have on our menu that our customers would buy. And so we recognize that a juice and a smoothie may come off to some as a luxury item. And so what are some other lower cost items that we can have on our menu? Because the bottom line is we have healthy products. We have health in a cup. We have health in a bowl. And so some of the things that we're thinking about is how do we launch products that may help people do some of these things at home? Do we need to launch a YouTube channel of a how-to, how to make a juice, how to make a smoothie? So we're thinking of those things as they come to us, but we're also thinking about what other businesses and partnerships do we need to have. And then finally, for our business, we're thinking about actual man and woman power. And when I say that, I'm talking about, should we employ as many people as we had before, or should we scale back and therefore get our juices into stores? And so we're not making as much juice here at our shop, but we're doing a wholesale model where Meyer could carry our juices, or, you know, Big B Coffee or Ferris Coffee or some of these other businesses can carry our products for us. And that would help us get back stable so that we can get back into this cafe model that we have going right now.
Right. To your point about the product line, I was curious if you have anything that washes the taste of isolation away.
We do. I believe that all of our products are are fantastic products. And one of our biggest sellers right now is the Rise and Shine Juice, orange, apple, carrot, and ginger. And that particular juice, it boosts the immune system. And it also just, it's called the Rise and Shine. It just brings a smile to everyone's face because of the vibrant orange color and also the dynamic flavors.
Jermail, that sounds absolutely amazing. What do you think is the most helpful to you in just keeping going these days?
A couple things come to mind. One is my family. Seeing my three boys and my wife and the smiles on their faces, especially for the kids, they know things are going on. We talk to them often, but they're still happy. They're still doing kid things. They're still hunting for bugs and playing with sticks and arguing about who's looking at who and all that good stuff.
Right.
But the other factor is the word love, L-O-V-E. I love my community. I love the next person. I love humankind. And, you know, for us, we consider ourselves as one that's planting seeds of love no matter where we are, no matter what we're doing. We want to be light to the community in lighter times, but also in the darker times. And so every time I deliver a juice, every time I talk to someone who has a question about a business application, I'm saying, this is an opportunity to show unconditional love during this time and integrity. And so, you know, our business and our household runs off of three principles. That's kindness, excellence, and integrity. And if we can all do those three things, we're going to get through this together.
Amazing. You know, the kind of business that you run is subject to lots of different considerations about reopening. There's the question about just getting back in production, but then there's the question about whether things like foot traffic will return. If you had the governor's ear right now and you were thinking about the concerns of workforce and customers and yourself and your family, what would you hope would be on her mind as decisions are getting made in Lansing about whether some businesses should get back to production?
Well, for me, it's that although I understand the economic impact of what's happening right now, I don't want us to all move too fast. I don't want us all to get out there too quickly and to begin to re-spread something once we hit the peak and it starts to go down. I don't want to continue to put people at risk. So to open the economy slowly. And then I would love to tell the governor to really look at how to best support my business, how to best support the farm workers, those who are out there, the farms and the migrant workers, how to support them with better wages, better working conditions and living conditions, and really, really consider how do we do more local business within Michigan, and to really look at the minority farmers, the farmers of color, and see how do we encourage them to continue doing what they're doing, because they've been left out as well historically. And so I know that as a state, we want to get back on our feet. We want to get things going together, but we got to begin to do this in baby steps. And so as much as I want my business to get out there, get back going and just start killing it when it comes to the revenue, I'm more concerned with the safety and health of the community.
Jermail Eddy, owner of Malamia Juice Bar and Eatery. Jermail, good luck with all this. And we just wish you safety for your family and everybody who's working in the operation right now.
Thank you very much. You all have a wonderful day. Thanks for having me.
As hard as this time is, some have found the experience of physical distancing offering unexpected opportunities. Detroit writer Desiree Cooper is riding out the virus as a full-time caregiver for two parents with dementia in Virginia Beach. She recently wrote about this in an essay titled, "In the Midst of a Pandemic, Some Are Breathing a Sigh of Relief." Here's Des.
Once again, race and class have become the divide between life and death, as the Black community bears the brunt of the coronavirus pandemic. Low-wage workers and working poor, many of whom are people of color, are stuck in essential, undervalued jobs, having to risk it all for the convenience of the rest of us. Meanwhile, those of means are watching Netflix, stockpiling goods, and keeping a social distance in a comfortable bubble. It's not easy for the luckiest to admit that what we are feeling in this time of terror is not fear, but a tremendous sense of relief. For some, the world has finally stopped its mad spinning, and they are not sorry for the chance to jump off. I have a relative with several chronic illnesses, including high blood pressure, diabetes, and obesity. And over the course of only 3 weeks working from home, his vitals have improved and his need for medication has dropped. Working from home has changed everything, he said. I was too busy before to plan and cook meals. Now that I'm not just grabbing convenience foods, my blood sugar has leveled off and I'm losing weight. Another dear friend could barely stand going to work every day. For her, the quarantine has been a game changer. She's working from home, but not having to actually show up to the office has made work more tolerable. Her stress is down. Her productivity is up. I'm pampering myself, she said. For her, pampering includes working on a project she's shoved aside for years. I'm doing lots of self-care. I've even taken a couple of baths rather than showers. What a luxury. Another friend is very dedicated to her job, so much so that taking off time was a problem. Last month, she was facing the daunting task of transitioning her parents into assisted living. Even after the emotional move, she still had to go through their old apartment and empty its contents before mid-April. She's one of the countless women for whom finding a work-family balance has been nearly impossible. There was no way I was going to be able to do it while working, she said. But suddenly, we didn't have to go in, and a way opened up. For a moment, I've been able to breathe easier. Although we are all haunted by the specter of death, we are also forging a new way to live. We're going back to planting gardens. Some are dispensing with the weaves, the dyes, the wigs, and the straighteners to get acquainted with their natural hair. Some are seeing this moment as a way to break from negative, even dangerous, relationships. Some are becoming our own barbers. As the work stress goes down, blood pressures are too. We are rediscovering the crock pot. Once we were too busy to listen to that little voice that said, "Call your mother, check on your friend." Now we hear that voice and obey. We are seeing how toxic our pre-pandemic lives have been, how stress is killing us, how important pressures really don't matter, and how all this time our priorities have been upside down. Even as a society, our values have transformed overnight. Appreciation for what teachers endure day in and day out has skyrocketed. Some of our lowest paid workers, the fast food employees, grocery store cashiers, nurses' aides, cleaning staff, garbage collectors, warehouse workers, are all understood as the engines of our way of life. We now see the internet as a public utility that must be made available to all. We are recognizing the need for some version of socialized medicine. I know I'm writing this from a place of privilege. I'm not homeless. I have no chronic medical conditions. I have access to food, water, and electricity. And although I'm sheltering in place with people who need caregiving, none of them are children who can make this ordeal particularly challenging. I'm an introvert, so social distancing is not the hardest thing I've ever done. But the difference between my life now and the life I had prior to the pandemic is that I'm more keenly aware of my privilege and infinitely more grateful. And unlike before, I'm aware that at any moment that privilege can be erased. Those of us who have survived thus far have experienced a monumental reset. We're being called upon to re-examine our priorities, ambitions, sense of worth, and our responsibilities to others. No matter how this ends, I know I can't go back to the same way of living again. I pray that we all will emerge on the other side of this pandemic. And if God sees us through, I pray that we will never, ever go back to normal.
That's Detroit writer Desiree Cooper. She sent that to us from where she's staying right now in Virginia Beach. That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow. Thank you.